Then I'm off to California, stopping in Eureka, Berkeley, Santa Cruz, Palo Alto, San Diego, Los Angeles, Santa Barbara. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Dear KBOO listeners, donate before our next membership drive starts and enter our sweepstakes. Grand prize is two benefactor passes to the 30th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, June 30th to July 4th. This four-day pass guarantees early entry, seating close to the front of the main stage, shade, food, and drink coupons, and much more. First prize is gift certificates to Brighton Bush offering overnight accommodations, hydrotherapy, hot springs, and more at the Brighton Bush Hot Springs in Detroit, Oregon. Second prize is a Portland Center Stage Flex Pass and dinner at Kale. To learn more about our sweepstakes, go to kboo.fm/2017 Spring Sweepstakes.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival. This year, the festival will be held June 30th through July 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. Festival passes are on sale now, including the Blues Buddy Pass and the basic 5-day pass at early bird prices. More information about the passes, the festival, and more can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2017.
It is 5:02, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News. This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Ricky King interviews former Grant High School student Madison Moskowitz on her response to a teacher's trivialization of the idea of rape culture.
Clean Air Portland has introduced a tool to track the source and type of air pollution in Multnomah County. We talked to Greg Bourget, executive director, to find out more.
And Teresa Mitchell speaks with FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley today about the Trump administration's sudden firing of FBI Director James Comey.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 10th, 2017. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wishes politics would stop interfering with his spring.
It's May and sunny, a blossoming spring. I wish I wasn't worried about all these political things. Russia, Yemen, North Korea, China, Syria, and Iran, all targets for a president who'll piss off anyone he can. Last night, Trump said Comey was no longer his homie and had to go away. If he'd only waited on his investigating, he'd still have a job today. And locally, the school board is asking for tons of money when they've already shown they're incapable of keeping safe water running. Political action's a positive distraction to keep our spirits from the dump. But no matter how we speak out, if we're high on life or smoked out, there's still that greedy narcissist Trump. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Well, the Portland Art Museum's has displayed controversial art in the past, it currently faces criticism for a proposed new building regardless of what's in it. The Mark Rothko Pavilion will be 3 stories tall, mostly glass, and will fill in the space between the Art Museum's 2 current buildings. The pavilion will block the current pedestrian walkway between the park blocks and Southwest 10th, a publicly owned easement that would be Southwest Madison. A condition of the museum being allowed to use that property is that pedestrians have free access to it from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. Under the museum's current plans, pedestrians would only have access when the museum was open between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. most days. Museum officials have said they will not change their design plans. City Council could change the terms of the agreement with the museum, decreasing the times of pedestrian access.
There is an increasing awareness about dangerous levels of air pollution in many Portland neighborhoods. Portland Clean Air is a local nonprofit determined to bring attention to the issue and to get results. KBOO's Ray Bodwell spoke with Executive Director Greg Bourget about the organization's objectives and a new tool they have introduced to track air pollution back to its source.
We have 1,400 members who are all donors who all live in Portland. We've been around for 3 years. We've been most well known for pulling the records from five agencies on 1,090 manufacturers and users of emitters of toxic chemicals in Multnomah and Washington County. I believe we're the only ones who have ever pulled up these records and made them publicly available from the five agencies.
This week, your organization sent out an email with a tool for people who, I guess, sense or smell chemicals in the air near their homes or school or place of business. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
It's using sensors from Mezonet. A local guy, he scripted a web page so that you can access the data. And so it's real-time data, and it tells you with about 7 or 8 sensors around the Portland area which way the wind is blowing at that particular moment. You go and you see which way the wind blows, and that's a good way of detecting where the industry that you smell is coming from. And then we also put up a web page that lets you look at 300 chemical smells, so you can start to determine what it is that you smell. And then people use our two maps, which we have on our webpage, and they can understand which industry is doing it. So we have a map that has all of the Department of Environmental Quality, air contaminant discharge permitted industries. We're the only source of that data. Even the DEQ does not make a map available of the industries they regulate. And the other is the hazardous substance information system of the Oregon State Fire Marshal, and that's chemical storage on site. Some industries have no permit, yet they're major polluters, like Ouroboros Glass was. And so we have a map of that, and same thing with the fire marshal. They make that information publicly available, but since there's no map, you have no way of figuring out which industries you want to be looking at by your house. So we were the first ones to make that available as well. So anyway, those two maps, you can determine then which industry you smell. And then we have also a volunteer team that can help folks make sense of the data or make sense of the smell and figure out who they're dealing with.
Your email was proactively sent out to your donor list. I think you mentioned there are 1,400. So folks who would like to become members and get on your mailing list, what's the best way for them to do that, Greg?
Well, because we're not an all-volunteer group, except for our Canvas staff and our bookkeeper, generally people get involved on our Canvas. But people are welcome to contact me at my email. It's greg@portlandcleanair.org.
Greg, I think here in Portland, many of us look out on the mountains and the green trees and the regular rainfall and assume we have fresh air. Is that not the case?
Well, the EPA in their last assessment, which is the National Air Toxics Assessment released in December of 2015, found that Multnomah County ranked the worst city in the United States for respiratory distress from air pollution. So I think we have a mixture of industrial solvents and wood smoke that's upsetting our lungs. And also, our problem with cancer risk is extraordinary. We have these unfiltered diesel trucks here operating in the Pearl, downtown, in Cully, in Upper Waterfront, giving us some of the worst rankings in this country, according to the EPA. For this known carcinogen, the worst carcinogen that's airborne, diesel particulates invisible, like radon, you can't necessarily sense it, and yet it's extremely dangerous. So it is counterintuitive that a place like Portland with these blue skies would have worse air pollution than New York City or LA in a lot of ways, but they have more of a smog problem, and we're lucky not to have that. But our air pollution is even more dangerous in a lot of the parts of the city. Seems like what we need to do about it is we need to work with our neighborhood associations and work with our neighborhood groups to put pressure on the government and industry to continue this process of having the first regulation. Portland's been unregulated. We want to see human health included in the equation of how they regulate industrial emissions. I'm hoping that these new tools will make it a lot easier for folks to understand the industries by their house.
More information is available at the website portlandcleanair.org. To volunteer or to get on their mailing list, send an email to greg@portlandcleanair.org.
A Grant High School teacher's trivialization of rape culture has generated outrage and opened up a dialogue on sexual harassment. KBOO's Ricky King has this report.
A paper issued to freshmen at Grant High School last Tuesday has sparked a controversy within and outside of the school. The paper is history teacher David Lickey's critique of the concept of rape culture. He reportedly distributed the essay after interrupting another class's discussion of the topic. He wrote that rape crimes are not the result of a culture that is accepting of rape and are solely the actions of a few individuals. The document goes on to express that, quote, "the very wording of rape culture to me seems a bit hysterical," end quote. He also writes that neither he nor any of the men in his life believe women are objects of exploitation. In his opinion, putting sexual assault in the context of culture is harmful and, quote, "proposes a culture war between all men and all women," end quote. In response, Grant students wore red on Monday to show solidarity with people who have experienced sexual violence. Grant principal Carol Campbell sent a message to families explaining that Lickey's paper does not represent how the school teaches on the subject. She apologized for any harm and said the school would work to make space for discussion around the issue. A video response from former Grant student Madison Moskowitz has been viewed 14,000 times on Facebook. I got the chance to speak with her. I was wondering what your initial response was after seeing Mr. Lickey's letter sent out last week.
My initial response was honestly, I didn't think that he was really serious. I thought perhaps he was attempting to play the devil's advocate for good reason, I think. But then, you know, after I read the whole thing, I understood that he was serious. And after that, I guess I would say disappointed.
He asserts in his paper that while rape and sexual assault do occur in our culture, that they aren't consistent with our values and that they're more of an exception. I was wondering what you made of that.
I understand his perspective. It misunderstands the argument that I make and that many others have made, which is that the term rape culture doesn't mean we live in a society where everyone rapes or, you know, something ridiculous like that. It's saying that sexual violence isn't taken seriously enough. And I think by assuming that only the violent act of rape is what makes up rape culture is a misunderstanding. It starts with jokes and sexist attitudes, unequal pay, you know, locker room talk, and it escalates into things like catcalling and sexual harassment in the workplace, then to violent crimes. It's not a rare experience among women and some men. It's not some huge secret, and it shouldn't be the elephant in the room.
Did you happen to see him reading the video on the Oregonian of another former student?
Yeah, I did.
What did you think of that?
I'm really glad that instead of instantly jumping to being defensive, which many people do when they're told that they're wrong, instead he did it the hard way. And he said, you know what? I was wrong. I apologize. And I'm learning and striving to do better. And I think that that is the best case scenario for anyone. And I wish that that was a more common response.
What ways do you think we can, as a whole, open up dialogue around these kinds of crimes?
I think that combating sexist attitudes and microaggressions, sexist jokes, and kind of outdated gender roles are things that everyone can do every day. Saying, hey, that's actually not okay with me when you say that. And speaking up when you feel uncomfortable with something is huge to change this culture of acceptance. And when people, you know, hear that and hear that more and more people are starting to care, even about the small stuff, that's what can lead to a sea change and sort of trickle up, I guess, to, you know, a reduction in the incidence of sexual violence. So I think that it's really easy to start small and listen to survivors. Check out a book from the library, you know, written by a survivor or written by someone with a really strong academic knowledge about sexual violence and learn more. Because I genuinely don't think there are very many people who want to act maliciously around this subject. I think most people are just uneducated. Luckily, that is an easy fix in the time of the internet.
That's true. More information, more than ever, is being widely available. What would you want Mr. Lickey to know?
I'm grateful that he took the time to listen to everyone who reached out to him and respond in a respectful way. So I guess I would say thank you for that. I would tell him, you know, what I've been telling everyone, just to listen more, because this isn't something rare. It's not something obscure. It's something that, in my experience, every woman that I've talked to about this has said, I feel the same way. I've experienced something like this. I can identify with your experience. I would just say to him what I say to everyone is just keep listening and seeking out perspectives different from yours.
That's great advice. Thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the listeners tonight?
I would just say there are a lot of people out there who have a continued skepticism about the existence of what has been called rape culture. But I think it's really important to understand that it's a widely accepted fact academically that 1 in 5 women in their lifetime will be a victim of sexual violence. I'm one of those victims, and far too many of my dear friends and family are as well. And I think that I would say to people still skeptical about this to listen to the women in their lives, open their ears to learning more about this, because it's serious. It affects so many women and really people all of all identities. And as long as that statistic is 1 in 5, this is going to be a huge problem. So I hope that if you listen to this segment with some degree of skepticism, that you take a moment to do some research, either personally or academically, because I think the more you learn about this and the more you hear from survivors, the better you'll understand just how impactful this is to me and to other people.
Thank you so much for speaking with us tonight, Madison.
Yeah, thank you for getting in touch.
Yesterday, in a video from The Oregonian, David Licky read an email he received from a former student who experienced sexual harassment at the school. She wrote that rape culture includes, but is not limited to, day-to-day comments and violations that can go overlooked. For example, she had her hair pulled as other students leered at her. After reading her story aloud, Licky said that, quote, I wasn't asking her, she didn't share it, I didn't see it, I wasn't curious about it, end quote, and that he felt awful that he did nothing to protect her. This has been Ricky King with KBOO News.
KBOO volunteer Merrick Bono testified at today's city council meeting concerning a manipulated arrest record and the violation of the Fourth Amendment. Merrick handed packets to the city council members with details of his situation before his testimony.
On April 13th, 2016, I was profiled and targeted by plainclothes Homeland Security and DEA agents at Amtrak. My Fourth Amendment rights were violated by the use of a police dog. Under the Fourth Amendment, probable cause must be established and a signed search warrant by a judge must be acquired before conducting any search. The use of police dogs to smell passengers and their belongings constitutes a search and is therefore a violation of the Fourth Amendment. I was arrested for not consenting to a search and taken to the federal building. I was interrogated for over 6 hours and was released without being booked and without paperwork. On April 14, 2016, I got a copy of my arrest record. The records were not updated to show the previous day's arrest, but I was made painfully aware that the police had manipulated my arrest record and put multiple false charges on my arrest record. Also, the city had not followed through with the expunging of my arrest record as per settlement agreement. The settlement agreement that the city council forced through, despite my informing the council that I was under duress at the time, and I wish to have them set aside this settlement agreement. Because the city council forced through the settlement agreement, they are required to follow through with all aspects of that settlement agreement. I have also not received a letter of regret from the city for my police brutality in 99, as per settlement agreement. Police manipulating my arrest record and putting false charges on my arrest record is a crime and constitutes police corruption. The city not following through with their settlement agreement constitutes negligence. On April 25th, 2016, I got another copy of my arrest record. My race had been changed from black to white, and the Amtrak arrest was labeled detained and released, not arrested. I believe this was done to cover up the illegality and severity of my arrest, as well as the unconstitutional use of police dogs to search Amtrak passengers. On April 13th, 2003, my IAD complaint rose to City Council. During that hearing, Mayor Vera Katz read a false portion of deposition from one of my witnesses, Kay Huxford. I believe this was done in effort to exonerate the police of wrongdoing and to make me look dishonest. Falsifying my witness depositions is a crime and constitutes city council and city attorney collusion and corruption. The constitutional rights of the people are the foundation that our country is built on and must be upheld no matter what the cost. If they are not, what is the use of having the Constitution? What is the point of swearing to uphold and defend the Constitution if the public officials you ignore the Constitution? If as public officials you ignore the Constitution. In efforts to protect yourself and your fellow public servants from liability, the constitutional rights of the people are more important than somebody's job. The Fourth Amendment is in place to keep us safe from unreasonable search and seizure by agents of the government. For the record, we are all innocent until proven guilty. That right should always be in place, otherwise we are no longer living in a free country, we are under tyranny. Here's the Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall be issued but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describe the places to be searched and the persons and things to be seized. I was not done in my case and is a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment rights.
Thank you, sir.
I gave every single one of you council members a packet of information, which included all this information as well as the CD I had of me and Commissioner Saltzman. We had an interview together, so you guys have all the evidence.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Merrick Bonneau at today's city council meeting.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for news from the BOO at 5:45, followed by Right to Survive at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow, we'll see the return of rain in Portland, and temperatures will drop to the upper 50s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you'll also have rain, but temperatures should reach the low 60s. On this date in 1994, Nelson Mandela took the office in Pretoria as South Africa's first black president. Mandela spent 27 years in a South African prison on the charge of conspiracy to overthrow the state. Quote of the day is from Nelson Mandela, who said, quote, "I've learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers that fear."
Jewel Face Williams opened Jewel's Catch One Night Club back over 42 years ago. It finally closed last year, but it still lives on in a new movie by filmmaker C. Fitz. Jewel supported a myriad of communities and at one point turned her parking lot into a soup kitchen. Jewel was still enjoying a recent birthday when KBOO's Zealous Marchant spoke with C. Fitz about the Jewel's Catch One Night Club and the film's screening in Portland.
The Jewel's Catch One Night Club in L.A. was often called the Studio 54 of the West. It was a hub for cutting-edge fashion and music for over 42 years in L.A. before it closed last year. While Jewel opened her doors for everyone, all races and sexual orientations, the club became a target of racism and homophobia, especially during the AIDS crisis. The film is narrated by CCH Pounder and features exclusive interviews with Sharon Stone, Evelyn Champagne King, Thelma Houston, Sandra Bernard, Bonnie Pointer, Thea Austin, Jennifer Lewis, and also features footage from Madonna's 2000 album release party, where rumors say she learned to vogue. It also features some of the best songs from the disco age. Jewel's story celebrates the music, fashion, celebrities, and activism that helped change the course of our country. And I have on the line right now C. Fitz. So from what I can tell about Jewel's Catch One Nightclub, it wasn't just a home base for people or a place to dance. If you could sum up Jewel's One Nightclub in a few sentences, how would you describe it?
Wow, it was so much to so many people. So many different people. It's hard to summarize. But it was a nightclub. It was a safe place for a lot of people. One of the first. And for a lot of different people, She fought racism, homophobia, sexism, and had four strikes against her when she started it back in 1973. And yet she persevered. She also not only built the nightclub and the safe space for so many and gave jobs to so many, but she also built a health clinic next door at age 56. At age 60, when she graduated, she went back to school at 56. And so that whole corner that she built became a village for all walks of life and a healing space, whether it be at the club or the clinic, and gave people a place to be where they are accepted. And that was, at the time and even today, you know, so much needed by so many. It was also a place where people could go where they were not wanted and shunned by their own family and friends and work, and she gave them a space to be and also a space for organizations to grow. She co-founded Minority AIDS Project, Ruse House, which was a shelter for women with AIDS and their children to keep the families together, and many others were co-founded and founded in that space that she created for them.
That's a lot. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's a lot. And think about, you know, all the celebrities that went through there, all the music, all the fashion that was developed and grown there, and the dancing. And it was quite a journey. For 42 years, she kept those doors open.
What kind of strikes were against Jewel? You mentioned there was lots of challenges.
She was female. Poor. Black and a lesbian. And back in 1973, imagine those four strikes against you and just persevering, standing up and being harassed. What the documentary dives into is just the pure harassment that she had to endure, that her business had to endure. And she just kept standing up to them. And they tried in every which way to get her out of there, to get her out of the space, to take it back over. They tried to buy her out. They offered her cash offers that she turned down. In 1985, she was arsoned, and it definitely was an inside job. They found the little plants to set it on fire behind the speakers. And, you know, it's not like the authorities were quick to help her out when she called either. It took them 20 minutes to get there when, you know, it should be a 5-minute quick drive. So she faced all kinds of obstacles. The city wouldn't even let her rebuild after 1985, after they burned her down. She had to fight the city to get the building permits and everything, because, you know, they were all hoping she'd just take the cash offer and go away.
Wow.
But instead she again persevered for 2 years. It took her get the building permits and to rebuild, and she finally opened in 1987, and frankly at a time that was already pretty tough for her, because that was during the AIDS crisis, where she lost a lot of patrons. And, you know, she was turning the parking lot into a soup kitchen to help feed them and to give them a space that they could go to.
This idea that with Studio 54 on the East Coast being so progressive, you know, and welcoming in all the different celebrities and artists and things that came out of that club, this idea of conflating that with Jewel's Catch One in terms of being on the West Coast, and this idea of course, the West Coast is progressive. Jewel didn't encounter any of that welcoming. And here we are today, you know, almost coming up on the anniversary of the Pulse Massacre. And there's this asking, you know, have we progressively really come that far in terms of spaces? You know, do you and Jules think that we have come closer to safety?
Yeah, we take the Pulse Massacre quite seriously, because we actually locked picture the night it happened and woke up to the realization that it could have been the catch. And, you know, we haven't come that far. There's still a lot of work to do. And using Jewel as a model and what she's done to stand up to hate and bigotry and to try and educate and teach, it's a big responsibility, especially having gone through it and been successful with the catch. But also, she faced that even in the later years. So there's always, it seems to be, a lot more work to be done, especially in light of the Pulse massacre. And we hope that in watching her life, her as an example to standing up and teaching people to welcome all walks of life, that we can help with the film and help shine a light that we all have to come together and we all have to keep working. And there's always more ways that we can do good, and we're not done yet. We have a lot of work to do.
I second that. Somebody under the rainbow banner.
Yeah, huh? I mean, definitely. How crazy.
Yeah. You know, my next question was going to be, why do we need nightclubs? But I feel like you almost answered that.
Yeah, one of the things that Jewel brings up in the documentary, which is sad in some ways, you know, one of the reasons why the club, she wanted to move on to heal at her clinic, and she felt that, you know, she was more needed there. Jewel goes where she's needed, and she creates what's needed. And the nightclub scene was dwindling with all the social media apps, social media in general, different ways to meet people and socialize. And so her nightclub, The Catch, wasn't as needed. There's other places, you know, to as safe spaces, and they exist online, as well as she did her job in integrating all walks of life to coexist. And that was another reason why The Catch, for the community that it was really built for, wasn't as needed, because, you know, gay, straight, white, black, they're all going out the same club. And that's wonderful, because she did her job in so many ways. But is there a need for nightclubs in general? One hopes, because otherwise we're just socializing on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter, and we think that those are real people, and we don't have the same connections. Mm-hmm. And that's going to change all of us. It's going to change how we love, how we respect our neighbors, and how we... our community is affected, and it's affected a lot if we don't come together. What's been great about the marches is we're coming together as groups, like Jewel wanted and provided through The Catch, except, you know, we're meeting and we're marching. Jewel has a big faith in the millennials. They are actually creating movements. Just like she created a movement by having Catch One open all those years, and in different ways outside of social media.
Do you want to talk about the event that's coming up, where they can see and when they can see this wonderful film that you've put together?
Sure. We will be at the lovely Hollywood Theater for Q-Docs on Friday, 6:30. We're super excited about our screening. And Jewel and I will both be there, and we'll do a Q&A following. As far as seeing the film, if you can't make that, we're working very hard at distribution. We'll hopefully be on an iTunes or a streaming source.
Thank you so much. Definitely extend our birthday wishes to Madam Jewel.
Madam Jewel, yes, I will. I'll tell her. Absolutely. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Can't wait to meet you up in Portland in just a few weeks.
Reporter Dan Heyman of Public News Service learned last night to not just be careful about what he was asking for, but also who he was asking. In Charleston, West Virginia last night, Heyman was arrested after repeatedly asking a question that Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price refused to answer. His question was whether domestic abuse was considered a pre-existing condition. The arrest came without warning. Charged with willful disruption of governmental processes, Heyman was released under a $5,000 bond and is being represented by a lawyer from the West Virginia ACLU. Earlier this year, Code Pink activist Desiree Ferruz was convicted of disorderly conduct for laughing during the confirmation hearing of new Attorney General Jeff Sessions. At that hearing, Ferruz laughed out loud when Alabama Republican Senator Richard Shelby stated that Sessions' record of, quote, treating all Americans equally under the law is clear and well documented. She has not yet been sentenced, but could receive up to a year in jail.
Since successfully passing a bill that would strip millions of Americans of health care and repeal the Affordable Care Act, very few Republican representatives have been holding town hall meetings. Out of the 217 Republicans who voted in favor, only 17 are holding meetings where constituents can voice their opinions on the controversial bill. Those who have held town hall meetings since the vote have been met with boos and protests. Republican Representative Raul Labrador told an audience member that nobody dies because they don't have access to health care. A 2009 study found that those without health insurance, even those who seek treatment for the uninsured, do not receive care equal to the care provided by private health insurance companies. Some Democratic members of Congress are holding town hall meetings for their Republican neighbors. New York's Representative Sean Patrick Maloney, who introduced the so-called Adopt a District plan, believes the new bill is not the solution to health care costs. He met with constituents of Representative John Faso, who voted in favor of the bill, but is not holding a town hall of his own. During the meeting, which Faso did not attend, Maloney said, "If at any time the current congressman wants to come here and do his job, well, I will pack up and I will leave."
Yesterday, a protest on Chechnya's anti-LGBTQ persecutions congregated outside of the Russian ambassador's quarters in Washington, D.C. The Chechen government round up and persecute men who are suspected of being gay and send them to secret prisons and concentration camps. The protest was orchestrated by the Human Rights Campaign and disbanded just before news of the Comey firing broke out. White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about the Trump administration's stance on the persecutions and stated she was unaware whether Trump knew about the injustices.
The ripples of Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey continue to spread. One source of concern is that the firing was triggered in part by a letter from Attorney General Jeff Sessions. The same Jeff Sessions who, after being caught lying to Congress, was forced to recuse himself from the investigation of Russian involvement in the presidential election, an investigation that Comey was leading. Sessions ignoring his own recusal has led for calls for his resignation or for his impeachment. The other letter involved in the firing came from Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who Comey had spoken to recently about increased resources for that investigation. Just hours before Comey's firing was announced, federal prosecutors issued grand jury subpoenas to associates of former White House National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. This morning, Senate Democrats announced a slowdown of the committee business until a special prosecutor is appointed for the investigation into alleged Russian interference in the 2016 election. The senators invoked an obscure rule that prevents committee hearings from lasting more than 2 hours after the Senate convenes, meaning all scheduled hearings were shut down around lunchtime. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer requested that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell should ask Sessions and Rosenstein to hold separate closed-door meetings with lawmakers. It's unclear how long the slowdown will last, but lawmakers have multiple options available to bring Senate activity to a crawl. Also today, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer announced that Trump has hired a private Washington law firm to help defend him against allegations over his links with Russia.
KBOO's Teresa Mitchell spoke with Colleen Rowley today. Rowley retired from the FBI in 2004 after 24 years of service and after testifying before Congress about mishandling of intelligence prior to the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center. Today they talked about the Trump administration's sudden firing of FBI Director James Comey.
Thank you, Colleen Rowley. Thank you for joining me. FBI directors are appointed for 10-year terms. I suppose as a legacy of J. Edgar Hoover's power, and Comey has been fired less than halfway into his term, do you think it likely that the Clinton investigation had become such a liability as of yesterday that immediate action was needed?
I don't think that the reason stated in the by either Donald Trump or by the Attorney General Sessions were the actual reasons he was fired. Comey has been politicized, as have most of the other intelligence directors. And he was successful, I guess, for several years now, if you consider that he was a deputy attorney general under the Bush administration. And essentially he Robert Mueller, the then FBI director, and all these other officials went along with highly unconstitutional illegal actions, including signing off on torture, signing off on warrantless monitoring, and even long-term detentions of people, of Americans, without charges or without right to counsel. So he signed off on all those things for the Bush administration. you would think maybe he would be the perfect FBI director if you wanted him to do things. But we're in a very unusual situation, an unprecedented situation, where the FBI had open investigations of both presidential campaigns. Of course, on top of the fact that they've had this whole history now since 9/11 of highly illegal, unconstitutional actions, and there's been zero accountability for any of that. And so people like Comey, who was able to get confirmed, I think almost unanimously, I had written an op-ed that appeared on the very same day of his hearing in the Senate for his confirmation hearing, suggesting that he be asked these hard questions about why did he authorize torture and how does he even deserve his reputation for integrity given what he went along with. And one senator or two did ask him some questions, but by and large, it was kind of a love fest, and he was almost unanimously confirmed. So in a way, these things that, go around come around, and I think he was trying to skate between the partisanship in Washington, D.C., both with the Hillary campaign as well as the Trump, who later won. It turns out Trump probably was, he seems to want loyal employees. He wants people that are loyal to him, and maybe he saw Comey as not being sufficiently loyal.
Where is the love?
They were investigating. There was an ongoing investigation of the ties to Russians, et cetera.
Well, Trump said recently as a week ago or so, that Comey had been giving Clinton a pass. Why would he now direct the FBI director's removal for overstepping his bounds in investigating Clinton?
Yeah, well, he gave him, Trump was first mad at Comey for closing the investigation of Hillary. Then he was happy when Comey reopened it. So it's gone back and forth. Again, I don't think Comey is that principled. He is simply, and now it's such a mess in Washington, D.C., with many of these officials, bipartisan, both parties, have people like Hillary Clinton think that they are above the law. But so obviously do officials in the Trump. In a way, this does go back to Watergate, when Nixon thought, when the president orders these things, he's above the law. That was the Nixon mentality. Well, certainly that was the Bush administration mentality, and as well as Obama administration. And now, of course, Trump, the third one that comes along, is following suit. And so it's very impossible, I think, to stay in good graces with officials that that think that they're above the law. And secondly, that the whole situation is politicized. And Comey is not the first head to roll. Think about George Tenet. George Tenet had to blame himself, had to fall on the sword for something he really was not responsible for, which was cooking the intelligence to make it seem that Iraq had WMD and had been involved in 9/11. Well, George Tenet, fell on the sword for that, but that really was the Bush administration telling him what to do. And again, this whole situation now is just out of control. Comey, like I said, can you imagine a time period where both presidential campaigns were being investigated by the FBI in the months before the election? I mean, that alone means a lot, that you have this kind of thing going on. And, an FBI director, good luck to the successor. I mean, I have a feeling that probably it will be somebody that is probably worse. It's hard to imagine somebody worse than James Comey, but I think it probably will be someone worse. People who are it seems like Trump, even in his reality TV role, he was looking for people that would follow orders and carry out his directives. And he fired Sally Yates for not following the one directive. So he's not looking for critical thinking or for people, saying this is legal, this is illegal. But on the other hand, if you look at the career of James Comey, as well as many of these other officials, they have allowed this to happen. Going all the way back to the Bush administration, where they all went along, it's going to be a perpetual war, we're going to have war powers. Well, James Comey signed off on all of that initially. As did George, George Tenet went along with it. Robert Mueller went along with it. And so, this is the problem of not having any accountability for having committed crimes and unlawful activity under the guise of a perpetual war on terror. This is what was going to happen. And it may get worse before it gets better.
Well, thank you for your comments and your historic perspective on this as an FBI whistleblower. Do you have anything to add?
Well, you know, people are making the comparison to Watergate. And I think that there is an apt comparison in two ways. One way is all the firings and recusals with these investigations going back and forth of each other. So that's similar, of course, to Watergate. And then the other way it's similar is exactly what I said at the start, is that Nixon and his men and his burglars and everything, plumbers or whatever, henchmen, they all thought they were above the law. And you've had this mentality now going on since 9/11. And I think it's going to get, they call it the imperial presidency, these orders that were a form of martial law. And again, if officials don't stand up to it, it just gets worse and worse and worse.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time today. For KBOO, I'm Teresa Mitchell.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. If you'd like to be a part of the KBOO News crew, call us or stop by the station. We would love to have you on the team. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ricky King, Dan Raphael, Merrick Bonneau, Ray Bodwell, and Jim Thompson. The producer is Kyle Carezzi. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, and you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, Joanne Hardesty welcomes back investigative journalist Greg Pallast with his report on the latest election crimes. At 9, it's Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, Jake Vermas welcomes author Renee Macalino-Rutledge and her book, The Hour of Daydreams, a contemporary reimagining of a Filipino folktale that explores trust, identity, and how myths can take root during our most difficult times. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, Portland native Mark Gustafson, the animation director of The Fantastic Mr. Fox, talks about his work with Will Vinton, Wes Anderson, and Guillermo del Toro. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Welcome to News from the Boo, your weekly update about what's going on in and around KBOO. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. Today, I'm joined by Zelos Marchand, KBOO's Evening News and Public Affairs Director, to discuss our search for KBOO's Sonic ID. Welcome, Zelos, to News from the Boo.
Why, thank you. It's very pleasant to be here.
Great. So you've been on News from the Boo before actually discussing this project. But for people maybe who didn't hear that great interview, could you explain what's the Sonic ID and what has been the process for looking for one?
Sure. So the Sonic ID is going to be something that KBOO can put with KBOO content that's going out into the universe. So we're at a point now where we're growing, and that means we're getting requests from other states and even other parts of the world to play KBOO content. That could be our music programs. It could be our public affairs programs. I can definitely say the news program has been asked to do that. Right. So in doing that, we want to make sure that as the content goes out there, it definitely is understood that it's KBOO content. So the Sonic ID is a really fun 3-second clip of music or sounds that is definitely it's definitely a KBOO sound. So we decided to go to our community and source artists who would be down to do this for us. Mm-hmm. And we did find them. We found some artists. And I was on the News from the Boo a little bit ago talking about that, who were down to take the feedback from our community and create something amazing in 3 seconds. So we've had John Loomis, who is a symphonic metal composer who's gone platinum in like Norway working on this, and Joe Spencer, who is a drummer, and they've worked together on projects before, and Jamie Spencer, which is they're partnered with Joe, but they also are a music therapist, and so they've created some really, really fun, creative, sometimes funky clips. So.
Do we get to play some of them?
You know, we get to play some of them. That's
great.
What this is about.
I love it. So you explained a little bit about how KBOO will use this Sonic ID, but could you talk a little bit about what would be some of the legalities associated with it?
The legalities of it, we've got to have something that is a stamp that represents KBOO. We have to have that. It's not the same as a legal ID, which is what you hear throughout the course of our day.
Right, whenever we say you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Right. It can be interstitial. That means it could be, you know, a combination of words and an idea with music, or just music and then just KBOO or KBOO.
Well, and I think that, I think it's just really great to be able to, understand the difference. It's not like we're legally mandated to have that, so therefore we can be more creative.
Right.
But at the same time, we also might want to, copyright whatever we create and also make it KBOO's property.
That has been a part of the ongoing discussion, too. As KBOO is growing, we're in the process, as you know, of making policies around that so that programs that have been here for a long time get their due and the communities get their due, but also just the practicality of it. You know, we have a Creative Commons license on, and so that's great. That supports our community mission and supports our volunteers and each other. But on the flip side, with growth, you really have to say, draw some sort of stamp of boundaries where so that things can be attributed properly. So that's where the ID comes in.
Yeah, I think that that's a great way also for once our content is out there to always, bring it back to KBOO. And so we're going to listen to some of those in a minute, but I was wondering if you could talk about the feedback that you've been receiving from volunteer and staff about the different examples.
That's been the funnest part for me. I mean, I have a strong music background, so of course I was like, yes, I'll do this. That would be kick-ass. Let's do this. So the feedback that I've enjoyed has been anywhere from I would have to say the way that I receive the feedback has been the most enjoyable, and it's what I love about working around music and arts and culture. So, one staff member had saved a screenshot. I don't know. I think they put the clips that I'd sent in a different program that seemed to be some sort of a different version of the sound program we have here, so they could specifically time by millimeters or something everything, and then had added that to a Google Doc that I was sharing with the staff. Mm-hmm. And so it was this very detailed on this at exactly this mark, could you cut this thing here? And then some people were like, yeah, I don't like that one Peter Frampton sounding thing. I'm not a fan of that one. Or some people would just be like, numbers 6, 9, 15, and 12. Boom. That would be the only feedback.
That would be me.
It wasn't just you. But I thought it was really funny that everyone had very different ways
of giving forget.
And I didn't really say specifics on purpose. I always just said, just if you feel moved in any way to step up and say you want this out music. Mm-hmm. And I did say, keep in mind, though, if you don't like it and you didn't say anything, that's on you.
Right.
So don't complain if you don't like it by the time it's chosen.
Yeah. So how we're going to decide?
Well,
one or two, or
I think we're going to use a dot
system. I love three.
We've got like off the top of my head, I think we've got almost like 10 clips.
Yeah.
And so we're doing the final draft was presented yesterday, and then I'm going to give folks till the end of the week to give feedback, and then the artist will do some minor tweaking to the clips, and then there'll be the actual reveal and then a vote. And so from this, the choices are really broad, and I'm looking forward to just the KBOO community at large to hear that. The artist got really crazy. At one point, they just did a disco version just because mm-hmm. they could. I'm still out to lunch about that. And it's not like we have to use everything as an ID. Like, the point of this also was to have extra clips that KBOO could use throughout its different programs. So we can have the one formal Sonic ID that's our right. stamp, but then there'd also just be options. Fun stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in case you do have a disco
right,
show.
Right, maybe you just feel like I could see somebody in the youth collective using this disco thing. I'm not sure how Aaron Yankee, our program director, would feel about
sure.
that, but yeah.
That's like I'm sure. Cool. So, okay, so do we get to play them all? The, I believe, 9 or 10 clips?
I would love if we could play all of them.
Okay.
I like the harmon. K-boo.
I like that
yeah.
one, too.
That's my favorite right yeah. now.
So here's a good question. Like, because I really like the Sonic ID, and some of them say K-boo and some don't. So right. what is your opinion about that?
Right. So we talked about this at the staff meeting where everyone was like, where's the handle? And I had to remind everyone, remember you said because we didn't know what the music would be like and that would dictate the handle,
right.
we instructed the musicians to just come up with musical clips. And then it would be up mm-hmm. to the KBOO mm-hmm. staff to decide what that handle would be.
Okay. So we could add that.
Right. So I didn't receive that in the first half of the feedback, and but I think I will in the second half, where I said, okay, this is the point where if you want something specifically to go with these sounds, this would be the time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So then we can decide really how that's going to, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. the artists were pretty much at our disposal, and I, you know, they wanted to know, like, what do we say? And I said, well, until I get some specifics from people, I don't really know. But just imagine that right. we were saying KBOO with this music in different yeah. ways.
Great.
So
So even if we do pick one of the ones that don't have any words, then we can do that.
Right.
Yeah. That's great. Love options.
Yeah.
So okay, which one are your top contender? You said the trio.
I like the trio.
Yeah.
You'll hear some harmonization going on, which right. is really awesome. It sounds really classy, but kind of like a very
that.
Smooth. Yeah. And it could go in anywhere. It wouldn't matter whether you're playing heavy metal or jazz.
Right. But another consideration also was around like public affairs content or news content.
Right.
Whenever you have a very heavy story,
right.
you cannot have cape.
Yeah.
Right before
this,
it.
Yeah. For instance, there was some that was like, there was like drum rolls, like, and we really, that would be like 20,000 people in Syria.
Yeah.
You know, and then that would be really disingenuous
really,
and callous.
Yeah, really difficult.
You know, but there's that one, the harmonization one. And then there's one that was unanimously loved by staff. And it's it's one that has a violin, just arpeggio.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
that,
I love it.
You know, and
you're great at reproducing them. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I like that one too.
Yeah, I like that one. And then I do like one of the get up and go. There's like a bass
right.
thrumming sort of a situation, which can be, could be exciting. Like, say, if you,
I think we like the same ones.
I think because we have good taste. I think that's where we're coming from, right? Like, I could see that going for like, It could be for anything, really. It was, right. It's upbeat, but it's not so upbeat that it's like petulant about anything. So.
Cool. So, okay. So stay tuned, folks. Very soon we'll reveal which KBOO ID makes it, and or we'll have them all play all the time, except whenever we send content out. Right. Then we'll have one.
Yeah.
So thanks, Zelos, for coming in and sharing those thoughts with us on News from the Boo. And folks, I want to let you know that tomorrow is going to be the first day of our spring membership drive, which means that, well, first of all, if you